Okay, welcome back to Drat Veterinary Podcast. It's been a hot minute since I've been on.
A little bit.
Yeah, I think my last one was either with Dr. Z or Dr. FIFA, who actually in the last year they've gone and done some pretty incredible things. But very quick life update with me. Let's see. Now you guys already know I got married. I have a kid now, and she's amazing. She's perfect. She's 4 months old, and things could not be better. Well, I guess for me.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Can't believe she's already 4 months.
I know. And who is this stranger of a person who I've never mentioned ever before? Update with the podcast. It's now going to be from Drat Veterinary Podcast to Drat and Drake. You know, Dr. Remington Drake over here. He's a good friend of mine that I've met some years ago. And well, our relationship has continued to grow more and more. And he's been so wonderful to join me on this journey of, well, hopefully being consistent with the podcast and having more than 10 episodes every 2 or 3 years. But a little background with him, and of course, you know, I'll let him take the floor. He is a Las Vegas native, and he can correct me if I'm wrong on that. You know, we met at Colorado State when I did my clinical year. We became pretty good friends then and kind of been keeping track with our group chat the last few years here and there. We had a couple projects together and then still maintained a great friendship. And now here we are today.
Here we are.
Yeah. So who are you, Dr. Remington? Who are you?
Yeah. So yeah, you got it right. I'm originally from Vegas. Well, technically Henderson, but you know, it's the Vegas Valley. So.
Gotcha. No idea. No idea what that means.
You've never been to Vegas?
I've been to Vegas. I never heard of Henderson.
Well, it's weird because so one of the things that was funny was when I was in vet school, I guess at the time, Henderson was ranked as one of the highest paid places for a vet to start out at for their intro salary. Yeah. And so it was like, oh, if you're a new grad, you should consider going to live there. And I'm like, I'm from there. I know what the reality of why that happened is because... Sorry, go for it.
I heard Vegas was pretty, it has a huge extensive veterinary community, and the reputation of Vegas ER or just Vegas veterinary medicine in general is you're kind of in the wolves. It's like, it's a crazy place to work for a vet, as a vet there.
I mean, I guess like growing up there, it was a little bit hard to have like a comparison, you know?
Sure.
But I think as far as I don't know, it's a little bit of a weird veterinary market. And like part of it too is, you know, there's some fairly established dominant player. Like Dr. Jim Nave is like the guy within the veterinary world in Vegas. Like he runs that city. But part of it is just like because of how established he is, and he's got like such a well-run operation going on there. Mm-hmm. Like the pipeline for like getting new vets in is like that structure exists for why, you know, the starting pay is fairly good,
competitive.
Yeah. But I mean, it's one of those things that's just like funny that of all the places that, you know, she would say, oh yeah, I should move here in the country, it's like, oh, I'll go move back home.
Well, so now a little bit more about that is your parents are both veterinarians, correct?
Yes.
So you were raised in, obviously,
could not escape it.
Is that like, I mean, was that really, so my sister, for example, she's always wanted to be a vet, or my parents are not in the medical field at all, right? But she's always wanted to be one, which I think in the back of my head was always kind of been an option just because I was exposed to it. But for you, was that like, was there ever a question, or this was just like, yeah, okay, I'm gonna do it?
I mean, I actually like, I guess it depends how far back you really want to go, right? But sure. No, I mean, I would say that as far as like once I started really like seriously entertaining like what kind of career I would go into, I think for a decent amount of time, I was seeing myself going into human med, which I think is, you know, kind of a common thing for a decent number of us in the vet world.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things that they're fairly adjacent in terms of, you know, the overall prereqs and just kind of, you know, medicine to some, you know, some basic
a similar
level
role
medicine
in society, and totally.
So it's something that I always had like extensive amounts of exposure to the veterinary world, but it's something that I think I kind of to some degree intended to pivot that into kind of a more human focus, but it over time, I think part of it too is like growing up, you don't, you know, you always get the question, and I, you know, got this so many times. It's like, oh, do you want to be a doggy doctor just like your parents? And I'm just like, I don't want to be like my parents. Oh,
cringe.
You know, I'm my own person kind of deal, you know?
And look what happened.
I know. And then after a while, you're just like, oh, actually, it's, you know, it's a good career. So
did because a very unique thing is, I mean, we have a bunch of friends or people in our community that whose parents are vets. And of course, they end up becoming vets as well. Hmm. And they end up taking over the practice. Now, I don't think you ever worked as a veterinarian under the umbrella of your parents and their hospitals, correct?
So part of it's, sorry, you can finish the question.
How come?
Yeah, I mean, part of it's just a timing thing. So both my parents had hospitals. My dad had several over his career, but by the time I graduated, he had already passed away. So that obviously wasn't an option for working under him. Mm-hmm. For my mom, she's feline exclusive, and it's something that it takes a very unique person.
Got it. Okay.
To want to be feline exclusive. Not that I would have been necessarily opposed, but it's one of those things that to me, I wanted to kind of travel the country a bit, kind of be exposed to other areas outside of Vegas. It didn't really have that draw for me to want to kind of come back home and gotcha. Stay in the little, you know, area that I was. Well,
I apologize for I'm sorry for bringing up, you know, the reason behind that actually had a lot more of an emotional background for why.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's part of life, man. Well,
yeah.
But
I mean, so you did end up doing some pretty cool stuff. You know, of course, you know, we're about 5-6, you know, going on to 6-7 years out. And throughout my time, I've encountered a lot of externs from vet school, or even people who are just recently graduated. And, you know, you get that kind of the number one question people ask is like, well, where should I work? How should I go about this? What should I do? You've always had a very impressive way of thinking where it's so pragmatic and so logical. But when you told me kind of your strategy and, you know, just your criteria, that was the first time I actually ever spoke with someone who was just so on top of their shit. Yeah. Can you explain kind of, you know, what did you do?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that, you know, I think to some degree I had the benefit of having parents already in the industry, right? And by extension, you know, you get, you know, feedback from, you know, people that they know in terms of, you know, what's an early stage veterinarian supposed to do with, you know, their career? How should you navigate, you know, getting that early experience? Because I think overall, you know, most hospital owners don't like to hire new grads. I mean, they're a lot more work in terms of training them up. They're going, I mean, like my dad said, you're going to make mistakes starting out, and you don't become a real vet until you've, you know, you've gotten through those experiences. Mm-hmm. And it's a rite of passage, you know? So it's something that it's taking on new grads is it's not something people usually seek out. Mm-hmm. So there's the whole, you know, back and forth as far as, you know, whether vets should do internships, not do internships.
And we have a whole episode on that we're going to go to.
Okay, cool. So should I save it until then? Or?
Yeah, let's save it. I think, okay. You know, I think what I'd be interested is essentially, you know, you jumped into emergency. I don't, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you were really open to general practice. To my understanding, you, from what you explained to me 6 years ago, was you looked at the places that were going to pay you the most while also promising quality mentorship. So you sacrificed location because I think you moved to Pittsburgh, right? For a year and a half or something like that. And so you didn't care about where you're going with the weather or whatnot. It was very much, okay, how can I maximize my income and my profit while also learning quality medicine?
Yeah. And I mean, it's not necessarily that it like paid me the absolute most because there were jobs that I turned down for more, but I think the biggest thing for me was like, Definitely the early stage mentorship. I wanted a place that I felt was solid in terms of, you know, getting exposed to capable vets that were interested in teaching. But kind of, and this kind of speaks to the, you know, the upcoming episode on internships, is the pay disparity is substantial. And it was 100%. More substantial back then, you know, at the time when there's internships for $30,000 a year. And, you know, compared to, you know, a vet that's not doing an internship, it's a pretty massive pay drop. So it's, you know, it's not something you take lightly. And especially early on in your career, you know, one of the things that I kept in mind was like, any amount of money that I can put away to save for retirement, like that over decades will compound into something that's going to, you know, it's going to be a significant enough difference over that many years that, you know, what you save early on in your career is so important for the growth of that portfolio. So to me, it's, I kind of looked at it as like, this isn't a decision over, you know, $40,000. This is a decision over, you know, hundreds of thousands to potentially seven figures over the very long term. So that's really what I'm, you know, looking at from the financial perspective. But obviously, you know, the people that are strong advocates of internships, their opinion is, well, you're going to suffer in terms of mentorship if you do that. I think to some degree, I lucked out in that, you know, you have to have a hospital that's in the right place at the right time with the right team willing to take you on. And honestly, I wouldn't have traded my first year out for anything. That I felt I'm really appreciative of the team that I had. So I joined in on a hospital in Pittsburgh that was ER specialty, and they had a really robust ER team when I joined on. It was, I think, like 11 or 12 ER docs. Wow. They had a criticalist, they had several specialties. And I'm eternally thankful to the ER docs that I worked with, a bunch of awesome people. I still think of them all the time, that they're a lot of wonderful people that I got to learn a ton from. And it's one of those things that I felt pretty well supported. A lot of people would complain that, you know, even in an internship, sometimes you're kind of just thrown to the wolves, and, you know, you have people you can call, and, but there's people that will still be left alone early on in their internship. That I didn't really feel was the case for me, that I felt like I was pretty well supported with coverage from other doctors, people I could call. Like I was really happy with how it went.
How was, I mean, you know, you kind of, for a good year or so, you're about there for about a year and a half to 2 years, was it?
2 years.
3 years.
Two.
So during that 2 year stint, you know, and of course we have a lot of things we relate on. We have both partners also in the veterinary field who are doing residencies. Mine just finished, of course, as soon as she gave birth to our daughter, but yours is, I think, in the middle of her second year, right?
Yeah.
In ophthalmology. But can you share with me kind of how that felt, just kind of separating yourself from your, you know, your people, you know, you left your veterinary comrades from all those 4 years, you moved to Pittsburgh. Was there anyone that was close to you in your family or friends growing up? How was that for you socially? Cause that seemed to be the biggest sacrifice you had to make.
Yeah. I mean, it was hard. I mean, I think looking back on how I felt doing it, I mean, it was one of those things that I don't think I ever questioned that I felt I had to do it, you know. And I think part of it was that my dad kind of had the attitude, like when I was picking my undergrad, he was just like, you know, you need to kind of spread your wings a bit and have that personal growth that comes from moving kind of out on your own and kind of getting an established sense of who you are, you know, what you want to do with your life. So his thing was like, you need to draw a radius on the US map and pick somewhere outside of that, you know, so you can have that distance and that growth.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that he gave me that advice, because that's kind of the approach that I had with applying for my first job as well. But yeah, I mean, my primary thing was that I was going to go wherever I had to get that sweet spot in terms of, you know, really strong first year mentorship. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it essentially meant that I was moving away from everyone that I knew to a city by myself. You know, I was long distance with Steph, but you know, it was a hard 2 years.
I bet.
And I felt like I almost kind of just like lived like a monk. You know, I mean, I had friends that I ended up making.
You still live like a monk.
But yeah, it was, you know, I think it was a 2 year period where I had a lot of, you know, internal, you know, introspection on like what skills I want to grow into and, you know, what I want to do. So
I can relate a little bit to that just because, you know, I moved to Florida. I mean, the difference, of course, is I had my significant other. But moved away from all my friends and family from San Francisco to there, jumped into ER and kind of essentially really kind of grew out of my shell as a legitimate doctor from there. Of course, I did GP for a year and a half, but my mentorship was quite limited. But you now then 2 years in Pittsburgh, I believe Steph then got matched at an internship in Florida. Is that the timeline? So you guys since then have moved to Tampa.
Yeah.
Which is what, 2.5-3 hours away from me, and so we've seen each other. That's actually probably how we got like closer over time.
Last 4 years, four with traffic.
Four, yeah, four hours.
As much as we would want it to be two and a half, it's four.
But that's kind of maybe even catalyzed our relationship too, just because I mean there was a couple of those hurricane scares where you guys came down and stayed with us. I think I came to visit, you know, one or two times. So from there, you left your job in Pittsburgh. You went to Tampa. What did you do from there?
Yeah, so I took another ER position. And then, I mean, ultimately, it's something that, I mean, essentially my whole veterinary career has been ER. You know, I unlike you, I haven't done GP as an ER vet. And it's
not missing anything.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's pros and cons. And I think there's definitely, you know, been shifts where I've been like, you know, what I'd rather be doing, you know, primary care versus ER. But I think, you know, you speak to a lot of ER docs that have done both, and there's some degree of an addicting characteristic. I don't know, like there's just something about that you just keep coming back to.
I mean, that's what I did, right? I left ER for what, 6 months, went to GP, and now I'm back doing ER again. So yeah. I totally get it. And then what? So I think you worked for a company, and then for another what, year or two, and then did you move into relief afterwards?
Yeah.
Okay. And then of course recently you stopped entirely. And now you're kind of doing your own thing, which again we'll get into a different time.
Yeah.
Of course I know this is a personal thing. You when you have your mindset on something, you essentially go not 100% or even 200%. You essentially go 500% into something. You sacrifice your sleep. You kind of, again, you kind of shut everything else down. You go just full focused on these things. I know that you've been really into computer programming for quite a while, even before vet school, correct? So how, obviously, since I know you and I also, of course, come from San Francisco, so I have a bit of an understanding of like what that entails. How did you go about this? Tell me about that.
Yeah, so it's kind of a weird start. I never intended for it to grow into what it has. But I mean, early on, like in high school, I was always, you know, I liked tech. I liked computers, but it wasn't anything where I was actually writing code.
You're doing MySpace where you just add little.
Yeah, dude. No, I mean, it was more just, you know, you keep track of, you know, what's Apple releasing this year, you know, into like more like the hardware stuff and everything. But no, I mean, really kind of where it had its beginnings was, it was actually helping my mom that her computer running her x-ray machine at her hospital, essentially just crapped out. And I mean, part of it was probably that it completely overheated from too much cat hair on the back of the fan, that it, you know, wasn't ever anything that people look back there to clean off. So ultimately the drive partially demagnetized, and they lost part of the, I mean, the data was good. It was the software that ran the x-ray machine, either through the recovery or just from the demagnetization, like it was non-functional. And you would think, okay, just reinstall the software and it's fine. Well, the problem was is that the company that that wrote the software and sold it was defunct. Like, it was out of business.
Oh.
Yeah. And that was kind of a...
Why not rebuild it from scratch?
No, I mean, that's way too generous for what I actually ended up doing. But no, I mean, that sucks as a hospital owner, because you know, those x-ray systems are not cheap.
Yeah.
You know, talk about expensive software. That's some expensive software, right? So you basically, she was looking at this, and it was like the software as it was designed essentially had like these little mini programs that all had to talk to each other. And the problem was is that they just weren't communicating across windows and stuff. And there were some configurations that just were not being stored. But it was like close enough that I told my mom, I was like, just give me 2 weeks to just kind of fiddle with this and see if I can salvage it. And long story short, I ended up just learning how to do like basic scripting to be able to transfer information automatically between windows just based off of triggers on, you know, if this window appears, then it's gonna, you know, it was like basic stuff.
Okay.
But I got it working.
And that was your first hit of the drug. And then
and at that point, I was just like, well, this is actually kind of fun.
Was this during college or vet school? Or when was this?
This would have been
just as you're graduating college.
13. Then. Well, that would have been, solidly undergrad.
During undergrad, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was something that just after that, I then started kind of putzing around with, you know, some other things that I thought could use improvement in vet hospitals. And at the time I was working as a tech in ER. And that's where I was looking at, you know, how they were doing treatment sheets. And I was just like, oh, little flow sheets or something that maybe we can make electronic. Grown out of that. And
I've actually, obviously when I met you in 2017, we were in our fourth clinical year. You were coding quite a bit then. And that's when you kind of shared with me, you know, your side passion.
Yeah.
And I talk about you all the time. So whenever I do, I mention how you'd be in vet school, and everybody who's probably listens to this podcast knows how time demanding vet school is. Right. But you did it. I think you did pretty well in vet school too, but on top of it, you also continue to program. And I think a couple of times you might have shared with me your day-to-day schedule, and you can kind of correct me on this, but you had a class, and then right after class, essentially you go home and you go to your computer and you program. Let's say you finish class or clinics or whatever at 5, you go home, maybe get a bite to eat. So you go from 6 essentially till 3 o'clock in the morning, you're just coding. You're not focusing on too much vet stuff unless maybe there's an exam, but you'll code and then essentially go to bed at when the sun comes up, you go to class and rinse and repeat. Is that?
Yeah. I mean, to some degree, yes. I think ultimately it was a hobby that I tried to fit in wherever I could. Mm. And I mean, there were even times like during like some classes that I was sitting there kind of, you know, fussing around with something I was working on, you know, if it was like stuff that you're like, all right, we already kind of went over this.
Avi, one of my best friends from vet school, I mean, or if not the best friend, sorry, Avi, you know, I get so frustrated when I meet people who just have a natural knack for retaining and understanding information. Because, you know, for me, I did well in vet school, but I had to put so much freaking work into it to just to get to where I feel, you know, the tier level of you and Avi where it's just like, oh yeah, okay, there he is, and then let me just go ahead and move on to my hobby or the side passion.
Well, I think for me it was the coding stuff that actually felt pretty like easy to pick up. Like I don't know what it is. Like
I think depending on how your brain works,
it just jives with how I think. And so it's something that, but I like both, you know, careers. They both have really, you know, redeeming qualities to both aspects. So something that, you know, I've always kind of looked to see, okay, how can I combine these two things? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, definitely it was something that, you know, I just enjoyed it so much that I was, you know, definitely having nights where I was coding way up until 2 or 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
on weekends, you know, and it was just something that I it didn't feel like work.
That's great. And it's such a unique thing. I don't think I know too many veterinarians, aside from actually one of your CSU colleagues. I won't call him out just because, well, he's a pretty introverted guy working with some awesome AI. But yeah, not too many people in the vet field, you know, go into the, no, actually know how to program. And I think it is just because it requires two levels of thinking. It's very, very different levels of thinking. I tried it.
They're both pretty different.
Yeah.
I would say that honestly, like I think to some degree people can be a little bit intimidated by the thought of, you know, software development, but it's actually, I don't know. I don't find it that, like, I think it's something that if you took any random vet that we know and kind of sat them down for a day and taught them, I think they would get the hang of like the basics of it. Right.
I'd rather do an RNA on like an intestinal foreign body than have to, yeah. I don't know, that's relearn React.
But yeah, no, I mean, it's something that, you know, in all honesty, I think one of the things that really kind of kicked it into high gear was, it was during my third year of vet school that my dad passed away. Yeah. And I think for anyone who's gone through the experience of losing a parent, you have to find stuff to distract yourself. And for me, I chose that as my distraction. And it was to the point where, I mean, even, you know, that was a very rough year for me.
Understand.
And I think that, you know, you almost kind of use those hobbies as like a coping mechanism to almost an unhealthy degree.
Yeah. I mean, better than, you know, some people will go to drugs, alcohol, and abuse.
Exactly.
That.
Yeah. So for me, I felt like it was a productive thing that I could really kind of just dive into and just distract myself. Cause when I was working on that, I wasn't thinking about anything else. So, but the side effect of it was essentially I trained myself constantly in how to further design software. And I trained myself to spend long hours working on it. So it was one of those things that it just kind of, you know, over time, if you keep doing something repeatedly, it becomes a habit.
Which is funny at this point, you know, because, you know, your typical programmers do the opposite, where they'll go to work for about, of, you know, 8 hours, but do an actual maybe 5 to 10 minutes of work a day.
Right. No, I mean, they are hardworking people, but no, I mean, they, you know, I would say that they don't work in the same style that I do, which is, you know, for me, especially like when I was in Pittsburgh on my days off, I would, you know, hammer through coding all day. And my attitude is that, you know, I'm used to working these 14 hour ER shifts. I mean, at that time, because I was just starting out, there were some days I would have like, you know, 18 hour, 20 hour shifts. Yeah. But on my days off, basically I would tell myself, you sit your butt down and you're going to code from the time you wake up until the time you go to sleep.
Ridiculous.
And, you know, it would be 12 hours, 15 hours. And, you know, you learn a lot when you treat coding is like your own little internship and just hammer at it every day. So,
well, to the audience, just don't set yourself as a similar standard. You know, Remy is sick and he's got the work ethic of someone of an unhealthy individual, but also, I mean, inspiring at the same time.
You know? Yeah. I mean, there's definitely, you know, there's downsides to working yourself that hard that I think, and that's where Steph has been, I think, a very supportive person in my life, that she has, you know, I think counterbalanced some of my unhealthy tendencies and like working constantly. Cause I'm just one of those people that if I'm awake, I have to do something.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's definitely something I've learned about you for sure. And well, I guess I might be the opposite sometimes. Sometimes you have to keep me in check. Let's pivot.
Moving
back
on from the coding, because I know that wasn't supposed to be the main topic.
I think it's important. I think, you know, the whole point of this podcast really is to share, you know, our each individual unique stories. And yours is quite unique, because, again, I don't know too many vets who do what you do. But, you know, we can kind of go back into ER medicine, because that is something a little bit more of what we share.
More interesting for the majority of listeners, right?
Yeah, I don't know. We can talk about back-end coding database. It's fine.
It's so interesting.
what are your thoughts on the current state of emergency medicine? Emergency veterinary medicine, of course.
I have a lot of thoughts on it. I mean, it's a weird part of the field. And I think everyone would agree on that You know, you look at like how, I guess going way back to how it was when my dad started out in ER. I mean, basically at the time, like his vet school class was a bunch of guys, and it was pretty much all guys. I think there were three women in his class, which, you know, at the time was a big deal.
How things have changed.
Yeah. I mean, it's the opposite now almost, yeah. But yeah, at the time it was, you know, if you had a single woman in your vet school class, that was, you know, unusual. And it was a bunch of, you know, cowboy-esque type guys or guys that just got out of the, you know, military service and stuff. And, you know, a lot of them were going to go work large animal, and small animal was not as predominant as it is now. But at the time, taking after hours call on your own was the thing. So in the 60s, you know, when he was venturing into, you know, his own career, and he went into essentially, you know, ER medicine at the time, it was very much like you're almost kind of fighting for your own legitimacy as a vet that was offering ER, right? Like a lot of these guys that were vets out there took their own call. And if you're a guy that's trying to offer services overnight to clients, it was kind of perceived as stealing clients. And he even had other vets say, like, you're not going to succeed. We're not going to refer to you. You know, you're wasting your time. Yeah.
Okay. And has he always been an ER doctor through most of his career? Is it primarily ER medicine that your dad practiced?
No, he did GP, he did ER. I think he did equine for a little bit too.
Okay. So very classic 60s.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you're kind of the jack of all trades. Yeah. All right. Thing. But no, I mean, it was something that a lot of them were just had the attitude that, you know, it's, we take our own call. You're not going to have anything to do. And his attitude was, well, you'll get sick of doing that once you have the option of, you know, staying in bed and sleeping.
True.
And I mean, you fast forward to now, and I think for most vets coming out of school now, it's unthinkable to take your own after hours call.
Absolutely. Right?
For a significant, it's
for a small number. Animal.
Yeah, certainly. Mm-hmm. But it's something that, you know, now we're, and I think veterinary medicine overall is kind of mirroring, for better or worse, the structure of human medicine, right? That you have dedicated emergency departments, you have criticalists that are, you know, providing the next level of specialized care for pets. And it's cool to see, like, you know, how it's grown into
it just in the last 5 years, just since we've graduated, it's I feel like things have changed quite a bit already, you know.
Yeah, and it's something that I think I don't know. My impression is that people are still kind of figuring out the optimal model for ER, and, you know, especially you sprinkle in criticalists into that mix, and it's,
yeah,
you know, that, I feel like that's a whole hour of conversation as far as, you know,
fair.
I think criticalists run into.
I think a big part is almost, I feel like there's a level of pay disparity, if not lack of, just because, you know, my wife being a boarded specialist, who in a specialty that is rather niche and doesn't get paid as much as your ophthalmologists or your surgeons, there's a little chip on her shoulder where when we discuss the pay disparity or mild difference between an ECC doctor and a boarded criticalist, there are ECC doctors out there that are arguably making more just because it's based on production. And, you know, how do you fit in this specialty in this, you know, growing ER caseload, where they can still focus on the quality, or at least the specialty of their medicine,
get their money's worth
at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, my mind's going so many different directions.
Oh, yeah,
on this. It's something that I think, I mean, I guess looking at, you know, that specific issue with, you know, criticalists versus ER docs in terms of, you know, what roles do they fulfill, and, you know, mm-hmm. how should they be compensated? I mean, I don't think anyone would. I'll say it, that I think ER docs in general would agree that, you know, criticalists should be compensated higher. Like it just makes sense, right? Like they deserve it.
Absolutely. It just, but you know, when you mentioned the current business model or how it's shaped, right? That's kind of where, well, we're still figuring that out. I don't think hospitals with criticalists have really a good system where they can be compensated correctly.
Yeah. Well, I feel bad for, you know, a decent number of them that I've, you know, met and talked to, that I feel like they're—
Two of them being our close friends.
Yeah. I mean, they just, I feel like in a decent number of hospitals, they fight for legitimacy as far as, you know, respect from those around them and, you know, being compensated appropriately and kind of their role that, I mean, I think they're getting kind of encroached from ER docs in some hospitals, and from others, it's the other specialists that are there, but like, it's, they are such an invaluable role in a specialty center that I think it's something like, they're amazing to have on your team. And like, even the criticalists that I learned with starting out, like I, again, second to none in terms of helpful in terms of my growth as an ER doc. And I think we're still figuring out kind of how to make sure that they feel appreciated and properly backed up.
That's a good way to put it. I think, you know, because hospitals, I you know, I've worked at hospitals that don't have a criticalist, and we are just,
it's hard.
Just dreaming of it, right? We can only imagine how great it would be to have it. And then I worked with ones that have it, and it does feel like they're not treated with the kind of respect that they deserve.
They should. Yeah. Like they deserve to be appreciated for what they do, because they have a hard job. But yeah, no, I think it's, and I guess kind of, you know, stepping away from that, I think part of the hard part with ER is it is definitely a high demand department, at least from caseload, that, you know, a lot of stuff coming into a referral center is coming first through ER, and it's kind of the pipeline that goes, you know, out to the different specialties.
Mm-hmm. That's for ER, but specialty, right? I mean, I guess we can go into other ER.
Yeah, and there's so many different models of it, right? You have the after hours, you have the 24-hour standalone ERs. And I think it's something that there's definitely, you know, caseload to handle, you know, whatever model of ER. But it's one of those things that I think one of the biggest pressing issues for me is that the veterinary ERs, I think, are struggling to keep their clients happy with the services that they offer. That I feel for a lot of clients that come through veterinary ERs. And, you know, I've said to a whole bunch, you know, I know you don't want to be here. I know you know, the last thing you want to do is having, you know, your pet coming through an ER.
I always actually start off my introduction by introducing my name and then saying, sorry to meet you here at the emergency. That's my go-to.
I feel for clients having to come through them. And I think this is where, you know, it kind of opens up into the whole discussion as far as, you know, where can we best improve how we serve clients? Because I think—
So you think it's a service issue in ER? You think it's— is it?
I mean, there's issues all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's issues with staff retention.
Absolutely.
You know, ER struggle to hold techs, ER struggle to, you know, struggle to have healthy relationships with the specialty departments around them.
Yeah.
ERs can struggle to have healthy relationships with the primary vets around them. And ERs struggle with the clients that come through. I mean, it's one of those things that there's a lot of friction in a lot of different directions. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of burnout in the field as a result of that. So I think, and this is where this is almost something that I feel like we can go on an hour just on 100%. This topic alone. Mm-hmm. But to me, I think the medicine has definitely advanced pretty significantly from, say, what it was, you know, 50 years ago for what ER is for pets. And we're providing, you know, expanded services in terms of being able to vent patients, being able to put them, you know, on high flow oxygen, hemodialysis, you know, and obviously these are things that criticalists are you know, instrumental in being able to provide, but being able to have the support structure around, you know, everything below that level of care. you know, it's a good thing. It's just the, and this is something that comes up always in veterinary medicine. It's the cost that I think is really a hard thing.
It's tough
for people to get right. And I think one of the things that's sad to me is, you know, we as a field, you know, we'll put a lot of effort into like, well, how do we improve our techniques for doing CPR and non anesthetic arrests to potentially increase the survival percentage a couple points, or, you know, obviously we hope for more than that, but, you know, we're doing what we can to yeah. try to optimize that. But then you look at what happens with, you know, after you restore, you know, if you do save one of them, you end up in a situation where now their, you know, modified Glasgow score is a 5. They're sitting there being, you know, mechanically ventilated. And you're just at that point saying, okay, well, now they're going to need intensive care. They may rearrest. You know, you're having these conversations with clients that are at that point saying, okay, I'm happy we got them back, but this isn't sustainable.
No,
at this level. So then you end up yeah. having to euthanize. So it's one of those things that it's like, okay, well, are we really kind of focusing on, you know, the overall result of what we're doing?
Mm.
You know,
there is an ongoing, I think I've listened into a few CPR lectures, you know, not any CEs, but indirectly from like ER doctors explaining it to nurses. And it's like, well, you know, the purpose of CPR really is just to, if you're successful, is to buy time for the owner to say goodbye to euthanize, which is kind of a sick
yeah,
joke.
Yeah, I mean, and, it's sad. Yeah. I mean, know. It's something that, you know, I think, and this is where, you know, people have a lot of opinions on veg, but, you know, I think the thing that they get right yep. in my mind, which some people disagree with me, but I think they get it right in terms of bringing the client into the middle of what goes on. Mm-hmm. Cause I think it, number one, helps them have a much better idea of, number one, what's going on with their pet at every stage of, you know, their illness and treatment. Number two, from what I've been told, it seems to cut down on the conflicts that can happen between ER docs and their clients, because it is ultimately a low trust environment, right?
Yeah.
Which, as hard as you can try to say, look, I do care, you know, about what's going on. I do want to try to, you know, get a good outcome here. Ultimately, they've never met you before. Mm-hmm. And when the technician comes in with an estimate that's thousands of dollars, you know, like it just gives a vibe of like, who are these people? Why are they doing, you know?
You can't help but turn on your defense mechanisms
when exactly.
you're being threatened financially or just threatened in general, right?
Exactly.
So, no, 100%. And I agree with you. This is not sponsored by Veg. If you do want to sponsor us, right, yeah. a heads up. But I 100% agree with you. And I wanted to bring up Veg just because, I mean, when you talk about ER medicine nowadays, you can't not bring them up. They're such a growing right. component of ER medicine. Obviously, they're ER standalone. They are 24/7, but they're not ER specialty. And I think to a certain degree, many of the people involved in Veg understand that, because ultimately, if this is a case beyond their ER doctors, they will go ahead and refer it to an ER specialty. And I know a few critical specialists who have then been hired by Veg to kind of be medical directors, or if not, you know, play a large role in their consults.
Yeah. Now, for me personally, I feel like the interface between vets and their, I guess, veterinary teams as a whole and their clients is mm-hmm. where ER should improve the most. Yeah. I don't think that's a disruptive idea, right?
No, like,
I think everyone agrees with that.
I mean, Veg is the only one, and I don't want to keep harping too much on them, but, you know, when you bring up the issues with like vet retention, relationships within the hospital, vet tech retention, I mean, I don't have their numbers, but, you know, from anecdotally speaking with, you know, the people I know in the field, they have an incredible retention for many of these aspects.
Yeah. You know? Well, because I think a lot of the retention issues stem from the fact that, you know, and every ER doc nods their head at this, that on any given day working ER, there's a good chance you're going to get yelled at.
Yeah.
Someone's going to accuse you of stuff that is not reality. It's not true. People, I mean, in general, the amount of throwing under the bus that occurs from clients and primary vets towards ER docs, it's high enough that it's, you know, any given day.
Not even ER doctors, right? But ER technicians, even the front desk people.
Yes.
Like, at any given day, someone's getting yelled at. Someone's going to feel terrible.
Right. And it's not a healthy work environment, right? And it's something that I think that's where, you know, we keep looking at, well, if we just try to pay them a bit more, potentially they'll be willing to do it. And that works to some extent. But at that point, it's really not making people feel better emotionally about, number one, picking this career. Number two, you know, look at all the ER docs we know. I think we can both agree that there's some passive level of unhappiness for a lot of them on any given week. And I think that spills over into, you know, how people interact on any given day, that there's, you know, you're going to have team members that are burned out, and that creates friction and roadblocks to getting things done throughout the day. There's friction that can arise between team members and clients. And so it's something that I think, you know, any changes that we can make to try to improve that problem, like the emotional aspect of being in that environment, I think, and putting us on a better path to sustainability as a career and as a discipline, you know, a specialty, I think that's where we'll see improvements ultimately in patient outcomes. People, you know, specialists will be happier with ER's outcomes, you know, clients will be, you know, ultimately what counts is clients will be happier with what happens.
And I think we're going that direction. You know, we are all millennials, if not Gen Zers at this point entering, and we have our own unique wants and needs. And I think the veterinary field just being so many years behind compared to human medicine, which is also sometimes lags behind in terms of administration and leadership. But I think veterinary medicine suffers a little bit more. They're still trying to figure out how to please our generation, I feel.
I guess I'm hesitant to chalk it up just to like a generational.
No, absolutely not. There's so multifactorial, but I mean, we never even brought up COVID, right? And that's kind of a big part of, man, how many people have the caseload increased just from all the COVID puppies and kittens.
It was insane.
It's horrible, horrible.
Yeah, I mean, it just completely outstripped the ability to handle the amount of caseload that everyone was seeing. And the problem is that clients in general, I think, you know, vets as a whole don't really have good solutions to this problem, that it feels as though the you know, because we talk about how we're seeing increased number of clients that are reacting aggressively, being violent, you know, stuff like that. And I think it's, to some degree, you can kind of attribute it to say, okay, well, people are stressed, people, you know, are having harder time affording things, and like, it's understandable from that perspective, but at the same time, it's one of those things where we can't keep having that happen because it's actually long-term harming the field's ability to provide care. Cause then you're burning people out. The ER that previously had five docs now has two because three of them burned out from having that happen. So the wait time of sitting there for 6 or 8 hours for being seen previously would have been only one or two, but because everybody, you know, is more upset and getting more aggressive with the team members, it's I mean, it's a vicious cycle, right? So it's like, how do we break that?
I mean, you also have your clients' expectations. I think nowadays with social media and just having such access to all this type of information, clients can very easily be misinformed with how things actually should go, whether it's the treatment or the cost or anything like that. I mean, this is before social media, but how many people have these exotic breeds that spent all their money, you know, anywhere between $1,000 to $50,000 on a freaking French bulldog, and now they come in with aspiration pneumonia, and like the bill's $1,500. I'll even say that, you know, a fraction of the cost they purchased them from, they absolutely don't want to go forward with it. You know, there's just education. Yeah. I think is also a big part that is, I think the whole veterinary field, or the, I guess honestly, the entire medical science field is struggling to really get appropriate medication across.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, to me, it's like not even the, you know, spending all your money on the puppy, which, you know, obviously we know does happen sometimes, but I think part of it is, again, it just comes back to the trust issue, right? Because there's people that may have the funds to treat, but it's one of those things that, again, they just met you. And especially, like, I think one of the struggles is, you know, with like online reviews and stuff, people can say whatever the hell they want to say, right? And it's something that it's not worth engaging. And, you know, I know plenty of docs, and I'm sure myself, that people have written stuff that is completely false. And, you know, it's something that you see even working your shifts, that people call and say, oh, I don't like that other doctor because they said this and that. And you know, straight up, they didn't say that. You know, you were in the room when they were talking to that person on the phone, and they did not say that. You know, it's that kind of stuff. It's, you know, but that still gets put out there. And then they come in to the ER with that in their head, thinking, oh, you're this kind of person, you know, or someone leaves a bad review of an interaction, but they didn't understand the fact that, you know, you couldn't spend 30 minutes going over what, you know, is something that you would prefer to go over a 30 minute time span, but because you have 8 patients in your triage area that are fairly critical patients, you know, you have cluster seizures, you know, hit by car, you know, whatever, you can't take time to spend time with, you know, having that connection that you would otherwise want to.
Yeah. It's an art. It's an art to be able to, you know, try to create trust and a relationship within 3 to 10 minutes.
Yeah. And so that's where I think we, you know, I think it's a bit of a disruptive approach to say, okay, well, we're going to do away with the whole, you know, front of the vet hospital, back of the vet hospital, you can't see in the back. And still there's the majority of vet hospitals kind of essentially have that policy that clients are not allowed in the back area. And obviously there's legitimate reasons for that, right? In terms of, you know, you don't want clients being exposed to isoflurane or being, you know, exposed to sharps and stuff like that. But if you design the hospital layout to be accommodating to them, to me, it makes sense, right?
I mean, like, and again,
I would want them to see.
We've seen hospitals, especially, you know, an upcoming corporation that's successful in this model. So I 100% agree with you.
I think I support it. I think it's the right move. And I think the more transparency we have in terms of, you know, bringing clients into the full spectrum of how, you know, what the reality is for what ER medicine is within the veterinary world, I think we'll bridge that gap between the team providing the care and the clients that are ultimately, you know, having to approve it and feel good about what's going on, right? Like, they should see everything and be understanding of, you know, what's going on. So I support it.
Okay. Well, guys, everyone who's listening here, you guys are going to get much more of Dr. Drake, just because, again, he's now part of the podcast. So I hope, you know, I mean, of course, what we've had, as you can tell from this conversation, we have a lot of these talks. They can, you know, every subcategory of what we talk about can go on for hours, just because, well, he has got a lot of cool things to say. I am going to move on to, like, you know, the last part of this podcast that I've always been doing is our omosarcoma. I've been hesitant, to be honest with you. You know, I've been thinking about it. You know, is this something I want to keep going? For the time being, I'm gonna do it. But I just always feel like it's relatively the same thing that I always have developed. So Remy, you know, whenever the omosarcoma, I stole from one of my favorite comedians, Elisa Schlesinger, her podcast. I think she calls it top of the cob, where you start off, you know, it's the best part of the cob. It's nice and crispy and buttery, and the bottom of it isn't as good. So, you know, you bring up something that you currently absolutely like or love. You know, it could be like, oh, my favorite shirt, or oh, I love this current company that has this type of service or whatever. And then, you know, anything from what's pissing you off or what you don't like could be from, you know, noise canceling earbuds to, I don't know, some board game. I'll start first. I honestly don't have a sarcoma right now, but my OMA, obviously OMA being typically more of a benign tumor, sarcoma usually being more malignant, so you're good and you're bad. Currently, my OMA would have to be the San Francisco 49ers. They are doing so well. They're so fun to watch right now. I don't know how many people are into sports who listen, but, you know, I'm obviously from San Francisco. big Warriors fan too, who unfortunately they might be my sarcoma because they're not doing well as well as I like. Yeah. But the Niners, we were so promising last year in the playoffs. Of course, our third quarterback got injured against the Eagles. And then of course the Eagles went ahead, go ahead and blew it to Kansas City last year. So this year we're back on track and we are just trucking through it. I'm so excited. What's your
own? You make me feel bad for not following sports.
That's okay. No, it's
boring, man. I just,
you know, I know you are.
Work all the time.
but now you have to work on getting some good OMA sarcomas.
Yeah, I'm unprepared for this. I'd say my OMA is, well, my mom's planning on coming to Florida and visiting for a little bit.
So really?
I think, yeah, that's the, you know, I'm looking forward to it.
That's so nice.
Yeah, because obviously, you know, my whole family's kind of spread out around the country just from work and everything. So we're trying to kind of bring things together a little bit.
Is she going for Christmas or for the holidays or after that?
We're still trying to figure out the exact dates, but it's, you know, hopefully some time within that window.
Cause she's now retired, right? Or
yeah,
she's still,
she retired.
She should have visited you sooner.
Yeah. Well, it's like everything with like moving and, you know, it's busy. But
I think that's a great one.
I mean, sarcoma,
I know it's hard to, I mean, I can complain about Florida traffic all the time. And I feel like I've already used that like 4 or 5 times.
Solid fallback.
Oh, right? I hate it. I know. It's just, I feel it's just getting overused at this point.
Yeah. Because I think for me, like I don't know. You always focus on the positivity, right? And you just kind of let the.
Exactly.
You got to just dispel the.
Yeah. And we just kind of complained about ER. Brain, yep. Right? We spent the whole, like, you know, last 45 minutes maybe complaining about ER medicine.
Yeah.
So,
which I do want to have, honestly. Like, there's a lot of really awesome parts of ER. Of course. I don't want to completely just.
We're going to get into
the bad parts.
You know?
But, you know, I think in terms of, you know, where the conversation went, I think it's natural that those issues kind of bubble up first, right?
Yeah.
I think, honestly, and this is so Florida. Mm-hmm. It's kind of cold now, which
that's an OMA, man. What do you mean?
Vegas
guy, so I guess you
can okay, so I was acclimated to cold weather when we were in Colorado, right? But like now, since moving to Florida again, it's, you know, you just lose that capacity to,
I guess.
So I don't know, for me, I've got 2 shirts on. I think it's 71. It's cold.
My goodness,
it's cold, man.
Step
outside, it's going to be like high 60s.
Yeah,
it's...
it was 56 or no, yeah, 67 last night. Pam and I went on for a nice hour-long walk with the baby. Yeah. Oh, I had to put on a little winter coat or a windbreaker. Oh, it's great. Well, my sarcoma then. Shoot, I just had it. Oh, you know, there's so many nowadays, you know, and this has been going on for years, but they have so many different types of like automated systems for lights or switches or anything, right? And there is just too many. You know,
the paralysis of choice,
really. I mean, you and it's like, it's not like the, you know, they all connect with Alexa or Google Home, but you go on the app and there's literally hundreds of different types, and for you to integrate it, you now have to scroll with your thumb for good 10 seconds. You know, and just the way technology is, you know, advanced.
What are you scrolling on? Or
when you're trying to choose a list of the company of whatever light bulb you can
buy it online
integrate with your Google Home or your Alexa.
Oh, okay.
Right, you have to sift through that company. It just takes forever because there's thousands at this point, right? And they include all of it. You know, because Google's like, hey, you guys want our API? Here it is. Take it, you know.
Sounds like a user interface issue.
It really is. But there's just so many. And I get tired of it because now everyone has their own app that you have to first connect to. And then you can then hook it up to the Google Home or your Alexa. And it's just, I'm tired of that. I think we need to change something up. You know, you're an engineer, so maybe you can go ahead and do that.
Not my department.
All right. So anyways, I think Drake is here to stay unless we don't get enough listeners because, you know, we're both sensitive like that.
Right.
We will definitely have more episodes coming up. You know, we're recording this, you know, in December. This probably won't be out until January or so. But again, everyone who's been following, you know, I've still been getting people coming in and giving me compliments and reviews about this. And a lot of support. So really, I really appreciate everyone, you know, asking me to make more episodes. And my goal is to, yeah, we'll have some more. So other than that, thanks everyone for tuning in. We'll talk to you guys later.
Thanks for having me.